Welcome to Local Talk, a show that explores the people, the stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. And after last week's hiatus for the Grassroots Radio Conference, we are back with Clean Water Radio, a Friday series of Local Talk that explores this resource that is so vital to all Iowans. Later in the show, I speak with Mary Skopek, in charge of monitoring state water quality at beaches and maintaining the beach hotline. She talks at length about recent cyanobacterial algae blooms in Iowa, the biological science behind them, and what they mean for water quality monitoring in the state. But first, we bring you the news from Des Moines. On Tuesday, the Environmental Protection Commission made a final decision on the rule concerning confinement animal feeding operations that it was being required by the EPA to come up with to comply with the Federal Clean Water Act. As expected, this rule was passed unanimously by the 9-member commission. Here's what the commission's counsel had to say about the rule in his analysis of the proposed rule.
Okay. The EPA said with that we have what is required to fully implement the federal regulations, but no more.
These words, no more than the minimum, were repeated several times in the council's testimony. Now, to be fair, current Iowa code specifies that no rule concerning confinements can be more stringent than the federal code. Here's the response from Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, a statewide grassroots group that has been calling for a stronger rule. Adam Mason, State Policy Director.
This is one area where, thankfully, the federal rules and regulations are very vague and as such, leave a lot of interpretation open to the states. So our demands of issuing a Clean Water Act permit to every factory farm actually are not stricter than federal standards because of the vague nature of those federal rules and therefore would be acceptable. The EPA would sign off on that rule as well.
It would not be against Iowa law, which states that Iowa laws cannot be stricter than federal law.
Correct. And therefore would not be susceptible to a lawsuit from the Farm Bureau as well.
As our listeners can imagine, that was not the only point of contention between ICCI and the policymakers on the Environmental Protection Commission, a group appointed by Governor Branstad. CCI argued that because 5 members of the commission benefit financially from the weak rule that was approved, and because they did not recuse themselves from the vote was illegal. On Wednesday, the day after the hearing, CCI filed a lawsuit it had prepared for this eventuality.
I'm here with Adam Mason, the State Policy Organizing Director for Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. ICCI is planning to file a lawsuit regarding the EPC vote today. Adam, will you tell us about it?
Sure. Our members feel that today's vote at the Environmental Protection Commission to enact Clean Water Act enforcement rules for factory farms was basically an illegal vote, with 5 of the 9 commissioners having a direct financial interest in the factory farm industry. It's very clear to us that a conflict of interest exists, and so therefore, rather than taking our case to the Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board, who routinely dismisses ethics complaints, we're going to file our legal complaint directly in Iowa court.
Can you name the 5 commissioners who are involved in this lawsuit?
Yes. So the 5 commissioners who have a direct financial interest in the factory farm industry are Gene Versteeg, Brent Rastetter, Cindy Griman, Max Smith, and Nancy Kauser.
And are those individuals specifically being cited, or is it the EPC in general that is the defendant in this lawsuit?
So the lawsuit states that these 5 individuals have a direct conflict of interest, and as such, the EPC is the focus of the lawsuit. We are asking that today's vote be voided and that the rules be revisited, strengthened, and ultimately voted on by commissioners who do not have a conflict of interest. For that to happen, obviously, we're going to need some new commissioners, and that falls on Governor Branstad. These are all Branstad appointees, and we're very confident that Governor Branstad appointed these folks because he has an agenda, and that is deregulating the factory farm industry.
What do you think of the supporters of this rule and of the EPC stating that that boards and commissions need to contain members who are influenced by their rules?
You know, for, in general, we support that. You know, I think we want the best folks in their fields to be making choices on rules and regulations. That could mean that could also mean, though, that that environmentalists are represented on these types of commissions when it comes to regulating our environment, not just farmers. As it is, this commission, the Environmental Protection Commission, is stacked with industry insiders. There's no environmental voice present on this, on the Environmental Protection Commission, which is just a shame. I think also one thing that would be clear is that when you have a commission that has five individuals who would benefit financially from a weak rule, those folks should still know better to recuse themselves.
That was Adam Mason, State Policy Director at ICCI. What's interesting is that this lawsuit mirrors, in a way, a lawsuit brought by the Iowa Farm Bureau against an earlier EPC rule. The Iowa Farm Bureau attempted to use the court to invalidate a 2009 rule based on the makeup of the commission then. Of course, that was back in the days of a Democratic governor, so several of the commissioners were environmentally minded. The member it focused on was Susan Heathcote, a specialist in water issues for the Iowa Environmental Council. Iowa Farm Bureau said that because Heathcote was an environmentalist, they called her an environmental lobbyist, she had too much of a vested interest in the environmental issues brought before the Environmental Protection Commission. Earlier this summer, the Iowa Supreme Court struck down that complaint. Here's what Adam Mason said about the parallel.
Did your lawyer think about the case against Susan Heathcote when he was deciding upon how he would approach this case?
Sure. So the recent Supreme Court decision that was brought by the Farm Bureau against EPC Commissioner Susan Heathcote, former Commissioner Heathcote, is a little bit different. Our attorney, Joseph Glazebrook, has helped us navigate this process. And ultimately, what we feel and what we feel the courts will find is that Susan Heathcote, although she had an issue bias because of her employment as supporting clean water efforts in Iowa, she was still not voting on any rules that would affect her financial stake in an industry, which is what we have had today. It's five commissioners who are voting on a rule that will affect their bottom line.
Well, thank you very much, Adam.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Now, folks at Iowa CCI are very excited about the lawyer that Adam mentioned, Joseph Glazebrook. Although he's young, they say he's already won some very high-profile civil rights cases in Iowa, all of them against the Branstad administration. And those would be State versus Fallon, a case in which Mr. Glazebrook successfully defended the free speech rights of a peaceful protester at the Iowa State Capitol. Mr. Glazebrook was also involved in Rhodes versus State, where they were fighting for the rights of an individual with HIV who faced discriminatory and draconian criminal conviction. The person in question was no longer carrying antibodies, but because of the medications he was taking, but was convicted to a severe criminal sentence. And that lawsuit actually was not resolved because the Iowa legislature decided to change that law that had gotten him there in the first place. And then finally, Glazebrook was involved in ACLU of Iowa versus Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz. And that legal team blocked the implementation of a rule imposed by the Iowa Secretary of State, which would have made it more difficult for Iowans of Latino origin to vote. So a star lawyer from Des Moines, it will be very interesting to see this case develop. We're going to take a look back now at the EPC hearing itself. I was present at the Wallace Building and captured audio and witnessed some very moving testimonies that I thought our listeners would appreciate. Some background. The EPC issued its proposal earlier this summer and gave a public comment period for written responses of only 30 days. ICCI alleged that this written public comment period was much shorter than the usual 90-day comment period. Nonetheless, with the groups organizing, as many as 4,000 comments came into the commissioners during that period against the weakness of the rule, whereas a mere 100-some comments from farmers, commodity groups, and agribusinesses stated their approval of the rule as proposed. This was calculated as a 97% majority for a stronger rule. Throughout the summer, ICCI continued to gather petitions and by the hearing on Tuesday had a stack of 8,800 petition signatures for a stronger rule. So at the hearing, the first person to speak was from Des Moines Water Works, Linda Kinman. The Water Works is run by Bill Stowe, which, of course, has been an outspoken critic of agricultural practices that contribute such high levels of nutrients and other contaminants into the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers that feed its plant. Linda brought up the algal blooms that caused Toledo residents to be without water for several days and said that Des Moines is quite comparable to Toledo in terms of their systems and water sources. Essentially, she said that Des Moines could be the next Toledo. Here's her final assessment of the proposed plan.
If you pass this rule as proposed, it will not protect, much less improve, water quality in Iowa.
That was Linda Kinman, public policy analyst for the Des Moines Water Works. So Linda Kinman's testimony was followed by almost equal numbers of Iowa CCI members calling for a stronger rule and members of the Iowa Cattlemen's Association saying they liked the rule just the way it was. Here is a sample.
Good morning. My name is Vert Tigas. I'm originally from Carroll County and currently live at Adel, Iowa. I want to talk to you a bit about your upcoming vote today on the Clean Water Act rulemaking package. I understand that you think that you have a very good rulemaking package, and maybe that's true. The question is, good for whom? Is it good for the people in the industries affected because it satisfies the minimum that the EPA asked and agreed for you to do without stepping on as few toes as possible? Or is it better for the remainder of the people of Iowa who overwhelmingly asked to make the rules as strong as allowable in order to clean up our waterways and return our Iowa quality of life? I believe that it's the former. I can also understand why you may fear making the rules as strong as we have suggested. Let me give you an example of why you may have this inherent fear. There is a commissioner among you, according to DNR records, that has had two manure spills, one each in 1999 and another in 2013. The November 13th of 2013 spill was of 1,500 gallons along 260th Street in Lyon County. The 1999 spill was estimated to be anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 gallons, depending on the reporting source, the complainant or the co-owner. Yes, Jean Versteeg, these are from your records. Also, over the years, you have received 10 notices of violation for failure to submit MMPs or incomplete manure management plans for three sites combined. Besides these violations, you have failed to fix or repair large rodent animal burrow holes.
Your 2 minutes are up.
What's that?
You do 2 minutes are up. If you'd wrap up pretty quick, please.
Okay. There is a quote that Gene made that was quoted in the Wall Street Journal. Gene said, "The Clean Water Act is not needed. But I don't fear it because we have nothing to hide. But I beg to differ. I think that all of you on this commission have much to fear and make it a stronger package and much to hide. I am asking the five members of this commission who are involved in the affected industries to recuse themselves from this vote."
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Carney. I'm a fourth-generation farmer. I've been in the grain and livestock farmer since I came home from Iowa State in the mid-70s and joined my father. In 2000, my son joined the operation after completing college. Our cattle operation consists of cow-calf and buying feeder cattle to feed down our feedlot. We are in that 300 to 999 size. I do fully support the amendments of 64 and 65 requiring CAFOs to comply with NPDES permit requirements. These proposed rule changes were approved by EPA, a component of the work plan. Iowa code does not allow the state law to be stricter than federal law. Though this rule, all operations will be evaluated instead of one size fits all. This winter, my son and myself sat down. We went through our cattle feedlot options. We called an environmental company that we use in our pork operation. Greg referred us to a specialist environmental engineer. He came down, went through our feedlot, told us our options. My son and myself then sat back down and did the pros and cons. We weighed a lot of options. I go to a lot of cattle auctions, and I hear a lot of cattle going Kansas-bound, Nebraska-bound, leaving the state. So we decided to go forward with our plans. After Labor Day, we will start building berms, selling basins, adding more terraces, even though we have several terraces above our feedlot and intakes above our feedlots to catch as much water as possible from every entering our feedlots. This we plan on having done yet this fall. At my age, I could have said I'm done and not spend any more money. But what does that tell my son and maybe my grandson someday? So we're spending thousands of dollars to do the right thing. Don't tie our hands with more rules and regulations and drive my family and others, like my son and myself, out of the industry. Let's let the livestock industry grow, not shrink in our state, and make Iowa a proud livestock state.
Okay, and those were two people testifying at the EPC hearing in Des Moines on Tuesday regarding the Clean Water Act rule that was proposed for CAFOs. You might have heard the chair of the meeting saying that the ICCI members, 2 minutes were up. They changed the length of proposed comments from 3 to 2 minutes, and many people had to kind of cut a bunch of stuff from their testimony. The commentary at the EPC hearing went back and forth in this way, with every cattle farmer who got up to the mic explaining what they had done to protect the waters from their livestock waste, and every CCI member invoking clean water as a right and a common good. Finally, Barb Kalbach, president of Iowa CCI's Action Fund, gave a rousing commentary that focused attention on our children. And in fact, after her testimony, there were at least two cattlemen who relinquished their turn at the mic. They realized it was a hard act to follow. Her testimony was then followed by a very moving appeal from longtime ICCI member Joe Fagan. We'll listen to them both.
My name is Barb Kalba. I'm a fourth-generation family farmer from Dexter and also an Iowa CCI member. I've come before you many times. I would just like to say that I've listened to the other family farmers here today. I've heard about the wonderful operations they run, and I have no argument with that. But the fact remains that you guys need to go back to your the Cattlemen's Association and the Hog Producers Association, and you guys need to talk to your membership, because the fact remains there have been 730 manure spills since 1995, and somebody did it.
Right.
Not the people sitting here, maybe, but someone has done it. And with this kind of industry and this kind of massive amounts of animals, these things are going to happen. And when they happen over and over, the rest of us are exposed to 630 impaired waterways.
Right.
So it isn't me that you need to chastise because I stand up here and say I want clean water. You guys need to go back to your producer groups and say, you know, guys, we need to straighten this out because we're having a lot of regulations come down the line because someone out here is not doing it right.
That's right.
And the point that I would make to this group is that I wouldn't be standing here talking to you if there weren't 730 manure spills and 630 impaired waterways. And when you make your decision, they need to be strong. They need to be fair. I think we've been fair to people or we wouldn't have 730 spills that we're still fighting about. But bottom line is not me, it's not you guys, and it's not you guys up here. Here it is. 5 years old. Third generation down from me.
Uh-huh.
We need to protect these children. Now, if the producer groups can't do it, get their leadership together, then we're going to have to do it at this level, and that's back to you guys.
Is Chad here? Is Chad here? Chad was next. Chad Hafke? We're going to pass on you? Okay. So we're going to go to Joe Fagan. Joe, if you'd come up, please.
My name is Joe Fagan. I grew up on a farm in Dubuque County. and I have many in-laws who farm. I live in Des Moines, and I'm a long-time CCI member. I'm here today because of the importance of this event. Today, you are faced with the decision of whether or not you will pass a Clean Water Act rule that will protect the water of our state and the people who drink it from manure pollution coming from industrial factory farms. We ask that each of you choose today to vote to make a decision that benefits everyone in the state, the common good, the welfare of all, a decision that protects the environment of the state and establishes a new upward path for the present and future generations that hold factory farms accountable and makes clean and clear waters commonplace. We ask that you make room in your hearts to do the right thing, to place the good of all above the financial interest of a few, including yourselves. That can be hard to do. You may say to yourselves, I just can't do that. It's too hard. Too many of my associates, friends, my spouse, people in high places, wealthy polluters, wouldn't like me doing that. I just can't do it. If those fears and emotions are running through your psyche, telling you that you can't do it, we ask that you change your tape, examine your conscience, slow up the speed. Go to your deepest, in your gut, spiritual center. Gather your courage. Review what you taught your kids. Take a deep breath and do the right thing. Thank you.
That was Joe Fagan. And his appeal fell on deaf ears, and the rule, as proposed, was passed by Iowa Environmental Protection Commission by unanimous vote. But you know, Rick, the fun thing about covering Iowa CCI is they're a great penchant for theatrics. And we got some of that on Tuesday by chance. Some of the theatrics were planned ahead of time, and some of them were just spontaneous. So Rick Morrison, by the way, is the engineer.
Hello.
Hello, in the studio with me. Got up early to be here.
Strong coffee, not to mention.
That's right.
Yes.
And so, Rick, you'll enjoy the next part of the story because it involves our good friend Deborah Bunka.
Oh, sure. I know her. She's a great person.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely.
So the chairman of the meeting, Max Smith, somewhat abruptly closed the listening session, you know, kind of without any warning. There was one after the next person going up, and he kind of just said, okay, that's the last one. And ICCI had not yet delivered the huge stack of petitions. They had gotten 8,800 signature cards and taken great pains to gather them. So they had planned for these stacks of cards to be delivered up to the dais by the children and grandchildren of members to make a statement about, you know, the seventh generation, or rather just even the immediate first and second generation, and how they're going to be affected by poor water quality. But because the listening session was over, there was no way to introduce the children and what those stacks represented. Some ICCI members begged and pleaded from the audience, but the commissioner would not listen. So Deborah Bunka approached the podium and began speaking into the mic. The chairman demanded that the Iowa State Patrol in the room remove her. By the end of her testimony, she had three state patrollers around her, but none was making any move to take her away from the mic. Anyway, here's the sound that ensued from all of that chaos.
We want to come and present you with...
Okay.
We collected
8,800
signatures.
You're out of order.
Do you not want to hear the will of the people?
You're out of
order. We have 8,800 signatures from people that your comment period cut off. You don't want to hear it because you don't want to hear what everyday Iowans have to say. Somebody here said that the commission should be made up of experts, but where are the environmental experts? The only expert that was an environmentalist on this commission got ironically sued for conflict of interest. Well, we have 8,800 comments from everyday Iowans. You look at the faces of these kids and tell them that they're Iowa.
Okay, that was a completely spontaneous chant from the members of the Iowa CCI delegation that had gone to the Wallace Building on Tuesday to state their views about the need for a stronger Clean Water Act rule regarding CAFOs as point sources of pollution. You are listening to a special edition of Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We call these Friday shows Clean Water Radio, and we are glad you're listening, even if the commissioners won't. We just heard the final piece of a public testimony against the Clean Water Act rule that Iowa's Environmental Protection Commission passed unanimously on Tuesday. Iowa CCI is challenging this rule in court, saying that it is illegal because five of the nine commissioners who benefit directly from this rule did not recuse themselves for the vote. Of course, if they had recused themselves, there would not have been a quorum and the vote could not have moved forward. After this musical break, I'll be back with Mary Skopek of the Iowa DNR talking about algae blooms in Iowa. If you like science, stick around. Those pernicious little guys are actually quite interesting. We're going to start with Adam talking about the permits and then move into the Standells. How many hog factory farms will have to get a clean water permit in Iowa?
Judging by the DNR staff that spoke today, Randy Clark and Bill Aim, it sounds like they're going to leave it up to the producers whether or not they want to apply. So it's up to each individual factory farm corporation to apply for a Clean Water Act permit if they choose. Now, obviously, no factory farm corporation is going to choose to have stronger regulations. So it's going to be up to us to force the DNR to issue the first permits. Ultimately, we think they're talking about a handful of permits for the worst of the worst out there, the worst polluters, but we're going to continue pushing for Clean Water Act permits for all factory farms in Iowa.
I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you about my town. I'm going to tell you a big fat story, baby. It's all about my town. Yeah.
This must be the wrong show. We don't love dirty water here. We don't love it one bit. This is Clean Water Radio, and I'm your host, Greta Anderson. Tune in every Friday where we give updates and perspectives on this resource that is so vital to all Iowans. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to talk at length with Mary Skopek of Iowa DNR. She monitors water quality around the state at beaches and puts out advisories on a weekly hotline for those who might want to use our waters for recreation. Mary is also the director of the Iowa Water Program, in which volunteers monitor water quality. We only have time for part of her interview today. We'll continue it next week on Clean Water Radio. But here's what Mary had to say to me about cyanobacteria and other emerging threats in Iowa's waters. So, Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today.
And the show is Clean Water Radio. How are we doing on clean water in Iowa?
Well, Iowa generally has what we consider fair to poor water quality. We do actually a water quality index that we developed in the state of Iowa to tell us a report card on the state. And what we find is that we really rank in about the fair to poor category most of the year. And during the wintertime months, we maybe edge up to good water quality. But in general, if I were to give it a letter grade, I'd give it probably a C minus or D plus.
That's not good.
It's not the worst, but there's a lot of room for improvement.
And you put out these advisories for beaches. How frequently do you find that beaches need advisories?
So we test beaches, state-owned beaches, once a week, and we generally do that on Monday or Tuesday. If we find that the beach has a high level of E. coli bacteria, which is an indicator of fecal contamination, we would generally retest that beach, and then on Friday we issue advisories. We've been probably putting out four or five advisories for beaches every week. Sometimes it's the same beach. There are a few that seem to have consistent problems. And then we also look at algal toxins. Certain types of algae, basically a blue-green cyanobacteria, can produce toxins. And what we've put out so far this year is about 17 advisories for algal toxins during the season from Memorial Day to Labor Day.
And those algal toxins are the same thing that contaminated the water in Toledo, Ohio, right?
They are. It's called microcystin. So a certain type of blue-green algae that's called microcystis can actually produce this toxin called microcystin. And it's a concern for drinking water, which was an issue for Toledo. It's also an issue for recreational water. And we use the World Health Organization guidelines on that standard. Basically, if it's more than 20 parts per billion, we say that you really shouldn't swim in that water. For drinking water, it's really more like one part per billion, and I think that's what Toledo saw was levels above that one part per billion.
Is this something that, for instance, the Des Moines Water Works is able to remove from the water?
It's not generally something that the drinking water supplies are trying to remove. It is possible to remove it using granulated activated carbon, which some of our water supplies that have surface water sources do use some type of carbon to remove other contaminants. But really, it's not something we're specifically trying to remove from drinking water in the state of Iowa or really elsewhere in the country. So this is a new and emerging issue for most of the country.
Why haven't we heard about this before?
Well, we've been doing testing for recreational water since about 2005, and we have put out advisories, but I think the Toledo situation really raised a lot of awareness. We also think in the scientific community that we're seeing more of these blooms and that these blooms are becoming more severe, partly because of the precipitation patterns that we have with really heavy spring rains followed by very dry, stagnant conditions, ideal for these types of blue-greens that really like those kinds of conditions. So we think the combination of increased testing, precipitation changes, and just general community awareness because of the drinking water issue is raising that public visibility.
Now, you mentioned stagnant water. The microcystin, the cyanobacteria that produces it, that they're really pretty much limited to lakes and reservoirs, ponds.
We do find them in streams at times. And so, for example, this year we became aware of a situation where a citizen reported a chemical spill on the Des Moines River. They thought that there had been paint or something spilled because there was this blue-green, really fluorescent-colored water washing up on rocks. And so they called that in as a spill. And in fact, it was a blue-green algae bloom. And so rivers, when they become stagnant, can actually see some of these blooms. It happened after 2008 on the Raccoon River and on the Cedar River. And we see it occasionally on the Turkey River in northeast Iowa.
So just because we're not drawing water from, you know, a lake such as Lake Erie doesn't mean that we are exempt from this concern.
It doesn't. And I think it's something we need to start looking at a little bit more aggressively in the state of Iowa, because we don't do a lot of testing in our drinking water to see if we're having microcystin impacts. Now, Des Moines Water Works has been doing some of that testing on their own, as well as looking at just the number of algae cells that are in the water. But it's not something that's really, at this point, regulated by either the federal or state government.
You mentioned the World Health Organization. So they're kind of the standard instead of an EPA guideline.
That's right. They were the leaders in really putting together some guidelines. There was a health outbreak in, I believe it was Brazil, where hospital patients were actually becoming ill in a dialysis unit that had water that was impacted by microcystin. And so these things are worldwide, and the World Health Organization has been a leader in putting out some guidelines on that. But the federal government hasn't put out any standards at this point. It is something that EPA has considered for safe drinking water guidelines, but at this point we don't have a finished standard for drinking water in the country or in Iowa.
And so the algal blooms are very much related to nutrient levels.
That's right. So the algae, the blue greens, really are looking for a lot of nutrients. And when they're in excessive supply, they really go crazy, bloom very heavily. And in stagnant conditions, they actually have a competitive advantage over the traditional green algae. They often can float above the green algae and block them out from having good light sources. So in stagnant conditions, they become even more dominant than they would under just normal river or lake conditions. And so they've got this adaptation that allows them to produce toxins to kill off or to keep other things from becoming a problem for them. So they've got this great adaptation, but it's a problem for us in terms of those toxins causing health risks. But they're a little bit different creature than your typical green algae. So these are bacteria that can do some photosynthesis, and they produce sometimes this really brilliant blue-green color. Not always. So sometimes we see different strains that look like traditional green algae, but they're actually, again, the blue-green algae or cyanobacteria, and can produce toxins.
That's kind of a scary scenario. And, you know, there are a lot of lakes around and ponds, you know, in people's farmsteads. They might have a pond. And certainly if the nutrient levels are not controlled, going into that, draining into those water reservoirs, then they might be at risk, and they won't have you or your staff coming around and testing the water.
That's exactly right. And the only official death that's been recorded because of algal toxins has been from a farm pond or a golf course pond in Wisconsin. There was a teenager who was swimming in that, and the officials attributed his death to the blue-green algae toxins. But you're right. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of farm ponds in the state of Iowa. People have called in saying that they've got these algae blooms. Our recommendation is that you see a big bloom on your pond. It's probably safest not to recreate in it. One of the challenges with these blue greens is that they don't always produce toxins. So a huge amount of algae in the lake or in the pond does not necessarily mean that you have toxin, but better safe than sorry. So if you've got a farm pond or a lake or an area that you recreate in that seems to have an accumulation of scum, these blue-green scums, best to stay out of it because you can't be sure whether or not there's a toxin present or not.
And some of the public lakes, Little Wall Lake, for instance, or Hickory Grove near us, are not necessarily tested.
Exactly. So we test state-owned beaches that are on public lakes. If you're a county beach or a county park, we do have a program that allows for those samples to be sent to our laboratory, and then we run those samples for free. But not all counties participate. So, for example, Hickory does participate, but not all county parks. Only about 30 or 40 places in the state of Iowa are submitting samples to us right now out of hundreds. So it's not necessarily a safe situation to assume that you can recreate there if they're not doing the testing. So we recommend that those counties send in samples, but it's really up to them to decide if they want to participate or not.
What are some of the lakes that have had a lot of trouble with this microcystin producing algae?
Sure. Well, this year it's been Black Hawk Lake has had quite a few advisories. So there's the Black Hawk State Park as well as Denison Beach in the park. And they've had advisories almost the entire summer. In southeast Iowa, Lake Geode has had a few problems. Lake Darling is starting to see a few problems as well. And McIntosh Woods, which is a state park beach on Clear Lake, has had a couple advisories as well this summer. In the past, it's been other lakes, so there's not necessarily a good indication that just because this year Black Hawk Lake is having problems that it would have problems next year. For example, Big Creek has had advisories in the past, but this year, for whatever reason, even though there's been blooms, the microcystin levels have been relatively low. So it's a little bit of a gamble to know whether or not that bloom, again, is toxic. And really the only way you can know is by doing that laboratory analysis.
So being a single-celled organism, they can they mutate very quickly and change, and so the type of algae you have in one lake might be not the same in another lake, and one might be more heavily toxic or toxin-producing than another.
And it's really interesting science because it appears that the same strain of algae, so whether you've got the same species of the blue-green, for example, microcystis, some microcystis might be expressing the gene for toxin production at some times and not expressing that gene at other times. And so it's a little bit challenging for us to know what environmental conditions are spurring that particular strain to either show that or basically create that toxin or not. The science is rapidly changing in this area, but there's still a lot we don't know about. Why does a certain variety of microcystis produce the toxin at some times and not at other times?
So that's a matter of epigenetics rather than genetics.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And so it's a challenge for us because just the presence of microcystis does not necessarily mean that you've got a lot of toxin there or Anabaena or some of the other species.
And who is testing all this? Do you have a staff of, you know, a dozen people or so who go out and test? What's that look like?
So right now we have interns that go out and sample the beaches, and those come back to our water quality lab at the Department of Natural Resources. And at the end of the week, we actually run the test for microcystin. For the E. coli bacteria, which indicates fecal contamination, those go to the State Hygienic Laboratory at the University of Iowa. And again, they have a large staff that runs microbiology for the state of Iowa for a lot of things, whether it's drinking water or recreational water. So we split the duties on the testing, but the algal toxin testing is run by the Department of Natural Resources in our laboratory.
And let's talk about E. coli. We all know where it comes from. And is there any more of a story than, you know, this stuff is coming from livestock operations?
You know, there's a lot of sources of E. coli bacteria in the environment, which makes it really challenging. Everything from geese at a beach to humans at beach. We often find a number of dirty diapers, as well as when you swim, you do shed some E. coli. We've got livestock sources as well. Pet sources can be significant in certain watersheds, and there's been studies showing pet sources in urban watersheds can be especially problematic, as well as other waterfowl. And so when we go to a state park beach, for example, and we see high bacteria, we don't necessarily know if it's the geese, the humans, the livestock, or what have you. And that makes things challenging for us. We try and isolate sources. We try and identify possible sources and reduce them. But I've often heard it referred to as a symphony. So you, at different times of the year, it may be more dominated by the geese. And once the geese move along, that bacteria that we're seeing may be more dominated by human or livestock sources. So any one given time does not necessarily mean that that's the same source 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later.
Hmm. E. coli is something that is consistently treated by waterworks with the use of chlorine, right?
If you have a surface water source, you are required to do some sort of treatment for disinfection. And so those water supplies that are reliant on surface water or groundwater under the influence of surface water, so from river sands that are close to the river, for example, they would be required to do disinfection, and then they make sure that they aren't having problems with that E. coli in their water.
Okay. I've heard a bit about the problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Have you encountered anything like that in your work? I know that I heard a story the other day of someone who got had an open cut on his leg and went swimming in a natural body of water here in Iowa and was laid up for a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Have you encountered anything like that in your work?
It's interesting. Actually, the way we've encountered antibiotic-resistant bacteria is by using them for source tracking. So, for example, if there's a specific antibiotic that's used only with humans and we find resistant bacteria in the environment, then we know that they've been, I mean, basically know that that source of bacteria is coming from humans. Or if there's a particular E. coli that seems to be resistant to a livestock antibiotic, then we know that that bacteria is probably coming from livestock sources. So we've used it for source tracking. But we do know that in the environment we have a certain mixture of bacteria as well as antibiotics coming from wastewater sources, and we're likely to have some cross-transfer of bacteria becoming resistant to those low levels of antibiotics. And bacteria are really exceptional at giving each other information so that they can pass that resistance on to each other in ways that are pretty phenomenal and amazing. So we are not too surprised if we find antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the environment, because they are out swimming in a sea of antibiotics and other types of chemicals. So we haven't specifically done a lot of research to see what the prevalence of that is in the environment, but we know it's out there. And certainly one of the biggest concerns is whether we have MRSA-type bacteria, so the resistant bacteria that have caused big problems in hospitals, whether that's getting in the environment. And at this point, we haven't really tested for that or looked for that extensively. But it is something that I know other researchers are a bit concerned about, that MRSA-resistant bacteria might be out there in the environment. And once you end up becoming in contact with MRSA, it's very, very difficult to treat, because you've basically taken the toughest line of antibiotics and taken them off the ability to treat a patient. So in hospitals, it's a very serious situation, and we certainly don't want that to get into the environment.
So MRSA is an acronym, MRSA.
It is.
And standing for multi-resistant?
It's a staphylococcus resistant bacteria.
Right, Staphylococcus is the species. Okay, here's another question for you. It's a fascinating topic to me. I've heard a lot about pharmaceuticals. I mean, we talk about antibiotics, but there's a whole range of pharmaceuticals that people, you know, would excrete on a daily basis as users of those pharmaceuticals. Is this an emerging area of contamination in waters?
It is. And in 2001, the Department of Natural Resources, in cooperation with the United States Geological Survey, did some testing in the state of Iowa. We actually have sampling sites above and below our 10 major rivers. And we looked at whether or not, we actually call them personal care product contaminants anymore, because it could be anything from an antibiotic that you ingest to a musk in a perfume that you put on your body, and when you shower, it washes off, to flame retardants in children's pajamas that may wash off, as well as things that are in plastics. And as that plastic degrades, that ends up in the water as well. So there's literally thousands of different chemicals. At a conference this morning, they were talking about 12,000 different chemicals that they were looking at. We looked at about 300 of those chemicals in the state of Iowa, and we found that for example, for drugs, about 9% of the samples had detectable levels of drugs. And that downstream, during low flow conditions, downstream of our cities, we had a higher concentration of those contaminants than upstream of the major cities, which tells us that wastewater is a major source. We revived that monitoring in 2013 and are looking at a number of chemicals right now. We see some heart medications, we see caffeine, we see cotinine, which is a nicotine byproduct, see some antibiotics as well. And so it's something that we're certainly keeping an eye on and trying to assess what the potential health impact of that might be in the state of Iowa. One of the things that researchers are looking at is the concentration of those chemicals in fat cells. So you may take, for example, a fish and look at the concentration of those chemicals in fish, because just looking at a grab sample where we go out and grab a little bit of water and run a sample may not tell us the whole story if those contaminants like to be in fat. So we need to really look at that longer term in the accumulation of tissues. And some of the flame retardants and things like that may be a problem of developing ongoing building of those contaminants in either humans, fish, wildlife. And so there is concern about that long-term exposure, even low-level exposure, for for humans because that flame retardant has been linked to everything from autism to certain types of cancers. So we really want to be sure that we're not seeing that low-level contamination in Iowa.
What chemical is that that provides flame retardants?
We call them PFAS. It's a perfluorinated compound, and essentially it's the same. There's a lot of PFAS in the environment right now and in different chemicals or different products. So pajamas for flame retardants, you also see it in Teflon coating on pans. You see PFAS in, I think, coatings of different kinds of cans and things like that. So there's, again, hundreds of different types of PFAS chemicals that are out there in a variety of different uses.
So you were at a conference, you mentioned it, mm-hmm. You said that it was an international conference on emerging contaminants, and this was held in Iowa City. And so what new things did you bring back from the conference?
Well, one thing that I brought back was, again, our water sampling tends to be that we go out and take a grab sample. So we dip a jug into the water, come back and analyze that. And what they found is that may be missing, again, some of those contaminants that bioaccumulate in fats. And so some of the new technology would put actually essentially a fat packet out in the water, allow, it's called a passive sampler, where the chemicals go through a membrane, accumulate in the fat in that sampling mechanism, and then you take it out maybe a month later. And that by doing that, you actually pick up a lot more chemicals than if you just do that one grab sample. So one of the things we need to think about from an environmental protection standpoint is making sure that we're sampling in a way that's going to give us the most accurate picture of what's in our water bodies.
That's all the time we have today for Mary Skopek, water quality expert at Iowa DNR. Join me next Friday on Clean Water Radio for the second half of my interview with Mary, touching on Iowa Water volunteer monitoring efforts and some of the politics surrounding the nutrient reduction strategy at the Iowa DNR. We do have the hotline number for beach closings. It's 515-725-3434. That hotline is 515-725-3434, and that's the hotline that Mary coordinates. Also, you can go online to iowadnr.gov and do a search for beach closings or beach advisories, I should say, and you can get a map of the various water bodies in Iowa. This has been a special Clean Water Radio edition of Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, covering the developments in Des Moines at the EPC hearing regarding the state's new Clean Water Act rule, which is as close to status quo as the state's lawyers could get and still satisfy the EPA. We heard testimony from Adam Mason, the state policy director of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, other CCI members, Vern Tigges, Barb Kalbaugh, Joe Fagan, Deborah Bunka, among others. We also spoke with Mary Skopek, and we'll continue that conversation next week. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Rick Morrison engineered the show. Links to the audio and to related resources will be up on our website later today, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. As always, your participation as audience and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
All of us at KHOI would like you to know that no waterways were degraded in the production of today's show. KHOI cares.